This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nick Hornby, is best known for his novel High Fidelity, about a guy who owns a used record store and defines himself and everyone he meets by their taste in music. John Cusack starred in the movie adaptation. Hornby writes about pop music for The New Yorker. He's also the author of the novel About a Boy and the memoir Fever Pitch about his obsession with soccer, or football as it's called in England, where he lives. Last year, Hornby edited an anthology of short stories with profits going to the special school that his autistic son attends. Hornby has a new novel called How to Be Good. It's written from the point of view of a woman who has been married for 24 years. On the first page of the novel, she surprises herself by telling her husband she wants a divorce. She's a doctor who works in a clinic. Her husband David stays home, takes care of their two kids, and writes a local newspaper column called The Angriest Man in Holloway, illustrated with a picture of him snarling at the camera. The cynical persona he adapts for his column is not far from who he is, and she's tired of the negativity, the bickering, and the feeling that he just doesn't like her anymore. Here's a reading.
What did I think I was choosing when I married David? What do any of us think we're choosing? If I tried to recapture now the semi-formed fantasies I had then, I'd say they erred on the side of prosperity and health, rather than anything very difficult. I thought, I suppose, that we'd be poor but happy to begin with, meaning that we would be living in a small, cute flat and spending a lot of time watching TV or drinking halves of beer in pubs and making do with our parents' hand-me-down furniture. In other words, the difficulties I was prepared to tolerate in the early years of my marriage were essentially romantic in their nature, inspired by the clichés of young married life as depicted in TV comedies, or, possibly, given that most TV comedies are more sophisticated and complex than my fantasies, by building society advertisements. Then, later on, I thought, one set of difficulties, the difficulties posed by watching TV in a small flat and by eating baked beans on toast, would be replaced by another, the difficulties that arose when you had two lovely, bright and healthy children. There would be muddy football boots and teenage daughters hogging the phone and husbands who had to be torn from the TV to do the washing up. Golly gosh, there'd be no end to these sorts of problems, and I was under no illusions. Muddy football boots would be awfully trying. I was prepared, though. I wasn't green. I wasn't born yesterday. There was no way I was ever going to buy white rugs. What you don't ever catch a glimpse of on your wedding day, because how could you, is that some days you will hate your spouse, that you will look at him and regret ever exchanging a word with him, let alone a ring and bodily fluids. Nor is it possible to foresee the desperation and depression, the sense that your life is over, the occasional urge to hit your whining children, even though hitting them is something you knew for a fact that you would never do. And, of course, you don't think about having affairs, and when you get to that stage in life, when you do, and everyone gets there sooner or later, you don't think of the sick feeling you get in your stomach when you're conducting them, their inherent unhappiness. And nor do you think about your husband waking up in the morning and being someone you don't recognise. If anyone thought about any of these things, then no one would ever get married. Of course they wouldn't. In fact, the impulse to marry would come from the same place as the impulse to drink a bottle of bleach. And those are the kinds of impulses we try to ignore rather than celebrate. So, we can't afford to think about these things because getting married or finding a partner whom we want to spend our lives with and have children by is on our agenda. It's something we know we will do one day, and if you take that away from us, then we're left with promotions at work and the possibility of a winning lottery ticket, and it's not enough. So we kid ourselves that it is possible to enter these partnerships and be faced only with the problems of mud removal. And then we become unhappy and take Prozac, and then we get divorced and die alone.
Nick Hornby, thanks for reading that. And that's a passage from Nick Hornby's new novel, How to Be Good. It's never really clear to me that the couples in your books are particularly well matched in the first place.
They seem that's probably where I go wrong.
They seem to fight a lot right from the beginning. And also, in your typical couple in your books, the guy seems to have this obsession with something, soccer, music, you know, records, and the woman seems to be a much more kind of practical, down-to-earth type of person, and they don't, they complement each other but don't quite understand each other.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I don't ever quite understand what it means to be to be well matched as a couple, because you can, you know, you can both share a passionate interest in pedigree dogs, and you know, nothing else is going right for you at all. There are all sorts of ways in which we don't match up, and that could be, you know, temperamentally, or in terms of our ambition, in terms of our lifestyles. There are just probably too many things that can go wrong for that ever to make sense, I think, the idea that we're looking for a perfect mate.
The woman in your novel has an affair with somebody else as her relationship with her husband is going bad. And I think you capture something here. She says, what I really want and what I'm not getting with my husband is the opportunity to rebuild myself from scratch. My husband's picture of me is complete now, and I'm pretty sure neither of us likes it much. I just want that feeling of not having gone wrong yet. And that's the feeling she has with her lover, because she's a kind of new book for him.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's a very, very strong urge in all of us that, you know, in a sense, it's not wanting to be known, isn't it?
Well, to tell all your great stories over again and have somebody be amazed at them because they've never heard them before.
That's right. And, you know, I think if you've been in a relationship for any length of time, that feeling you have when you're telling stories to somebody else and your partner's sitting there and you think, Jesus, how many times has she heard this?
Right.
And it's depressing.
No, I know you've been asked this a lot, I'm sure, but whereas your other books have always been written from the man's point of view, this book about a couple is written from the wife's point of view. Why did you want to do it from her point of view?
Well, to begin with, it was a purely technical thing connected with the novel, which is that the thrust of the book is that her husband David, who's this grouchy, disappointed, permanently aggrieved middle-aged man, you know, he's in his 40s, he's got a bad back, and he goes off to see a spiritual healer and comes back a completely different person. He's full of love, and he wants to give away everything they own. And Katie, from having been the kind of moral conscience of the relationship, is suddenly on the moral back foot. Now, when I was conceiving the idea for the book, I knew that I wanted to write about a strained relationship that was put under more strain by somebody's spiritual conversion, and for the other partner to comment on it. And I have to say, rather sadly, that when I thought about this, it seemed more likely to me that it would be, first of all, the man that was permanently aggrieved and disappointed and angry, and also the man who would react more intemperately to some outside pressure. So that left me with the female as the narrator. But also, I really like writing in the first person, and you know, there are two genders to choose from, and it seems crazy to limit yourself to one for the rest of your career.
Since your previous books have been from the male point of view, were the things that you had to see differently even about your own life when trying to examine them from a woman's point of view?
I think that the big challenge is the frame of reference, that whereas my automatic reaction to illustrate something would be to choose some kind of cultural metaphor, maybe from a place that Katie wouldn't have experience. So it's rephrasing and reframing things that I think is the hardest thing to do. But generally, I do think that we're so much closer together, the genders, than we were. And I think there's a kind of extremism of masculinity which involves, you know, shaved heads and thousands of pints of beer, and an extremism of femininity, which is sort of frilly pink things, and that most of us occupy a space somewhere in the middle and change over pretty frequently. So I didn't feel too kind of scared about creating the kind of woman that I wanted her to be.
Were there things you actually had to ask other women about in creating her and creating her voice?
Well, it was a very interesting experience to give a woman a novel and tell her it's narrated by a woman but written by a man, and then ask her to comment, because line by line, whoever you show it to is going to come up with some pretty interesting stuff. And it did occur to me after a while that, in fact, if it had been a woman that had written this book and with a female narrator, various friends would have come up with just as many points and said that they hadn't been convinced. You know, if I hadn't told them in the first place that it was a woman author. I think authenticity is always in question in fiction anyway. And there are all sorts of kind of odd moments. There's a reference to Lee Harvey Oswald on the very first page of the book. And one woman I know said she didn't think women would make political references of that kind. And I started to get kind of depressed about it around about that point because it seemed so patronising of their own sex. So I left it in there.
My guest is Nick Hornby. His new novel is called How to Be Good. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nick Hornby, author of High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, About a Boy, and the new novel, How to Be Good. Last year, Hornby edited an anthology of short stories, with profits going to the special school that his autistic son attends. I asked him about that. Did your attempts to do good with that book figure into your writing of this book?
Since my son was diagnosed, I do think that my moral universe has become more complicated, I think, in ways that I hadn't expected it to be. For a start, I seem to deal with people who operate in a sphere of pure love and devotion. And, you know, I think, well, you probably know yourself, Terry, but when you work in the media and with books and pure love and devotion quite often is in short supply. There's a lot of bitching and moaning. You know, I'm working with all these people who just have fantastic degree of patience and resilience in dealing with very difficult children. So I've been really kind of bowled over by them and felt almost inadequate in lots and lots of ways. And, you know, doing this book was easy and fun and I was really proud of the book, but it still doesn't feel like a really big deal to do something like that.
Your main character, Katie, says that getting married and having a family is like emigrating to a different country. I'm wondering, though, if having like an autistic son made it more like emigrating to a different country because so few people in your circle of friends, I'm sure, experienced anything like that.
Yeah, I think it is a great separation thing that people don't really understand quite how different your experience of parenthood is, for example. You know, most of my friends have kids now, and they've always been incredibly sympathetic and respectful and so on, but they don't know what the day-to-day detail of dealing with Danny is. So you do tend to hang out with other people who are in the same situation.
What are some of the things that parents of children who aren't autistic would experience that you feel don't really apply to you?
Well, I guess, I mean, the basic thing is that everything's easier with kids who are not autistic, that it doesn't become such a big deal, you know, to go to visit somebody at their house, for example. I mean, Danny might just literally refuse to go indoors because he doesn't like the vibe, or there are other kids there and he's scared of other kids, and so, you know, visits of that kind can last anything from between, you know, 1 minute and 3 minutes, not usually much longer than that, but it's sort of, you know, most seconds of the day things are different from the other experience, the normal experience.
Nick Hornby is my guest. He's the author of High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, and About a Boy. He has a new novel, which is called How to Be Good. When your novel High Fidelity was made into a movie, I think some of the records that the people in the record store talk about and buy and some of the records that the main character is most obsessed with are changed, in part because the setting is a few years later and also the setting in the movie is America, whereas the setting in the novel is England. Did you help choose what the records in the movie were going to be?
No, I didn't, and I'm kind of glad that I left it to them because the guys who made the movie, John Cusack and the two co-writers, they're exactly the right age, and they're completely obsessed with music. I think DV, I may have read this somewhere, has 10 or 15,000 vinyl records. and is constantly buying pieces of hi-fi equipment. And no, they're absolutely the right guys to choose it. And I think I wouldn't have got it right, either generationally or culturally. So I left it to them, and they did a pretty good job, I think.
Do you know if they had to change some of their choices because the rights for the music were too expensive? You have to buy the rights before you can use a record in a movie.
No, as I understand it, the only reason they ever changed their mind was because they kept changing their minds, like Rob in the book. I think I remember somebody saying that Disney had made more clearances for High Fidelity than for any other movie that they'd ever been involved in. And I think the music budget for High Fidelity was almost the same as the total budget for Fever Pitch. But they didn't suffer from that, at least.
Are you following soccer, football as carefully as you used to?
I follow it as carefully. I wouldn't say that I've felt quite the same way about it. I still live right next to the soccer stadium, so it actually doesn't take a big chunk out of the day or out of the week to go and see them. It really is walking around the corner. But the game has changed so much in the last few years, in England in particular, I think. And there are almost no English players, for example, who play for Arsenal anymore. It's become much more kind of mercenary, in that players come from France or Italy or Spain or Holland and stay a year and then start saying that they want to go and play somewhere else. And I think this is actually beginning to loosen the bond between fan and club.
You know, it's funny, in the movie A Fever Pitch, when the guy in the story is trying to convince his girlfriend or fiancé to get a home that's right a block away from the
yes.
soccer stadium, mm-hmm. I was thinking, you're crazy. Sure, it's going to be convenient to get there, but there's going to be mobs of people parading past your house all the time, and that's not going to be pleasant. So what is it like to have lots of fans coming and going from the stadium, passing by your home?
Well, this is a subject of great debate among residents of the area. lots of them aren't very keen, and actually lots of them are. But generally speaking, I think people do quite like living on top of a football stadium. It's like waking up on a Saturday morning and having some kind of fun fair or something right in your front yard. That there's an atmosphere, there's a buzz. People are selling things from the wall outside your room. It's just much more interesting than most places, and I really enjoy it. And the game finishes at 5 o'clock, and everyone's gone home by 5:45. It's not such a big deal.
Do people ever drink a lot of beer and urinate in front of your house?
That can happen, yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't bother you?
I'll be honest about that.
You just take that in your stride?
Yeah, well, yeah, my stride sort of takes me over it, if you see what I mean.
Right. I think I got that cliche wrong. You take it in stride, not in your stride, right?
No, in your stride's
in your
good.
Stride?
But,
okay.
Yeah, but I'm saying I'm striding over it, so.
Okay. You've been writing music criticism for The New Yorker magazine. Do you enjoy writing about music, functioning as a critic?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly hard. I think that writing about music is much, much harder than writing about books, where, if you're going to be lazy, you can always retell the plot or you've got some kind of take on the content, but to actually describe the way something sounds is tough, I think. And I think it's not something that you can do forever unless you're very, very resourceful. But I do enjoy it, and it's fantastic just being exposed to so much more music and music that I might not have heard otherwise.
Did you ever play an instrument or sing yourself?
I have done. I don't really want to be drawn on that. You can ask me about my parents' marriage and everything, but you're not going to talk to me about my harmonica playing, okay?
Is that because you don't think you're very good?
It's just a very personal thing.
Fair enough.
You've gone way over the mark now.
I've crossed the line.
You've crossed the line. I'm going to walk out. My headphones are going to be thrown on the floor.
Well, I better quit while I'm ahead and thank you right here. Well, Nick Hornby, thanks so much. Good luck with
the novel and the new movie. Thank you.
Nick Hornby's new novel is called How to Be Good, a movie adaptation of his novel about a boy finished shooting last week. It stars Hugh Grant and Toni Collette. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.